In 1973, the New York City Police Department created a hostage negotiation team.
He's not up against the gun. He's up against the man's mind.
When you're defusing a human bomb, it's the same as when you're taking apart a real bomb. If you skip a step, it's going to blow up right in your face.
Talk to Me tells the high-stakes true story of the world's first hostage negotiation team. It changed policing forever. Talk to Me.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today on the Prosecutors, when a college student was raped and murdered in her dorm room, police arrested a suspect who pleaded guilty. But did he act alone? Everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, by my chulissima co-host, Alice.
Chulissima. That's beautiful.
It also might be chulissima. I'm not entirely sure how to
pronounce
it.
I have no idea what that means, but it's Italian Spanish.
It's Spanish. It means the coolest or a beautiful person who is truly loved.
Oh.
Which you are both, Alice. Both. The coolest and a beautiful person who is truly loved by someone, I'm sure.
Not you, apparently. Thanks, Brett. You really know how to deliver these compliments backhanded in the most delightful ways.
I try. Gabby, who provided that, loves you, truly. So hello to Gabby in Querétaro City, Mexico.
Ooh. Oh, I love it. I love it when we have people from all over the world write us. That's awesome. Thanks, Gabby. You're the best. You help Brett say nice things about me when he's literally at a loss for words.
It's true. It's true. Thank you so much, Gabby, for that. It's probably the nicest thing that's going to happen during this episode because, as usual, Alice, we have a horrible, horrific tale to tell.
Oh, gosh. I know. So right now in the news as we're recording this is obviously a lot of news about the Moscow, Idaho quadruple murder also happening at a college campus. And then when you hear about this, like as a parent and as someone who's not that far removed from college, and I remember how I lived in college, which was absolutely carefree. Like I was on top of the world. Nothing could touch me. I was certainly not going to be the victim of a crime. These types of stories are just a crashing reality course. And they seem so senseless and so sad to cut short a life that has so much potential so early.
It's totally true. When you're in college, you think you're invincible, like everybody, and you do a lot of really dumb things. And unfortunately, even when you do smart things, and even when you do everything right, sometimes really terrible people will find you. And we're gonna see that here. So I've talked about this documentary before, The Hunting Ground. It's very good, very disturbing, about sexual assault on campus and how a lot of times, unfortunately, campus administrations just do a really poor job dealing with it. Hopefully they've gotten better as there's been more attention on that. And that's part of what we're going to see today, though this is sort of a strange case, and it just shows that danger can come from anywhere. Today we are talking about the case of Katie Autry. And some of you are familiar with this, but I think some of you, or a lot of you, aren't. It's not a case that gets covered a lot, and that's one reason we wanted to talk about it. So there's a few things you can, if you're interested in this case, you want to look more deeply into it. There's a book called Bluegrass, A True Story of Murder in Kentucky by William Van Meter. Southern Fried True Crime covered this. One of the few podcasts it has and did a good job with it. And then if you're into watching stuff on television on the case with Paula Zahn on Investigation Discovery, did this as well in an episode called Voices in the Dark. So feel free to check those out if you're interested in going beyond our conversation in these couple episodes where we talk about this case. I do want to say Happy New Year to everybody. This is our first episode of the new year. We are recording it right before Christmas, so Merry Christmas to you as well. But you'll be getting this as our first episode of 2023, Alice. Hard to believe.
Oh, man.
Hard to believe. Started this podcast in 2020. Now it's 2023. You're still going strong.
That is awesome. Well, happy new year to you guys. And what a way to start the new year with. Devastating true crime story.
It's true. That's the one problem with true crime. It's often depressing. So let's just go ahead and dive in. So this case is going to take us to Bowling Green, Kentucky, where Western Kentucky University is located. It is also the home, and a complete aside, of the Corvette manufacturing plant. So if you have a Corvette or if you like Corvettes, it may have been made in Bowling Green, Kentucky. The Corvette Museum is also in Bowling Green. I know this because my wife is originally from Richmond, Kentucky, and when I would drive up to see her, I would always go through Bowling Green and right past the Corvette Museum. Another piece of trivia, a sinkhole opened up right under the museum. It's like the worst possible place to have a sinkhole, and like swallowed some Corvettes, like classic Corvettes. So that was...
No way.
That was not cool.
Like out of a movie?
No, it totally did. Like out of a movie. Oh my goodness. They were able to get them out and restore them, but at the time it was a pretty big deal, and they've rebuilt it. And presumably there are no more sinkholes lurking around, but that's where we're going. I mean, you know, middle of nowhere, Kentucky. Sorry to those of you who live in Bowling Green, but it is a small little town. It's called Western Kentucky University. It's more like Central Kentucky. But there is not a lot going on in Bowling Green other than the Corvette Museum. And it's the kind of place where you might think, Alice and I were talking about this before we started recording, where you could send your kids to school and they would be safe. But unfortunately, like anywhere, tragedy can strike in Bowling Green as well. And when firefighters responded to a report of a fire at one of the dorms on the campus of Western Kentucky University, they could never have imagined what they'd find. A young woman was on fire. So they're called to this dorm room. They're expecting, like everything else, if you've been in college, you know, everybody's lighting candles, they're cooking on the hot plate, they're doing all sorts of stuff they're not supposed to do, and half the time you have the fire truck show up to put out somebody's grilled cheese sandwich. And that's what they're expecting to find here. They're not expecting to find some kind of tragedy, but very quickly they realize this is far worse than anything they could have imagined. So they find this young woman, she's on fire, and she is literally on fire. The firefighters, they pull her from her room, they put out the fire in the grass outside, and she is rushed to the hospital. She is still alive, but she has suffered terrible burns, third degree, and what's described as fourth degree burns. I didn't realize you could have fourth degree burns. I thought third was as far as it went. They take her to the hospital. And frankly, the doctors who treated her there, it was pretty obvious she wasn't going to survive. But they did everything they could to give her a chance. They put her on a helicopter and they send her to one of the finest medical facilities in the country, Vanderbilt University Medical Center, which we've talked about before in not a great light. But in this one, they have one of the finest burn centers in the world. So this was the place to go. And they did everything they could there, but despite their best efforts, the damage was just too great. It took 3 days, but she would eventually succumb to her injuries.
And the woman we're talking about, the victim, was Melissa Kay, or Katie, Autry. She was an 18-year-old freshman at Bowling Green. And Katie had had a rough life. She never knew her father, and her mother wasn't very present in her life. She had a younger sister who described Katie as a mother figure to her, which is less comforting when you realize that Katie wasn't even 10 years old at the time. You know, when she hit 10, she and her sister were put into foster care. They really didn't have parents around, and at such a young age, Katie took on the maternal figure in protecting her younger sister. And in this, she was lucky, because not everyone who enters the foster care system, you know, enters a good situation, but she did end up with a family that loved her and supported her, and her birth family would eventually become an important part of her life too. But that's a rough, rough start to life. And it wasn't all, you know, rainbows after she found this foster family, because her foster parents were strict. And not unlike many kids who come from strict households, when Katie tasted the freedom of college, she went, well, a little wild. And that's really, I mean, honestly, Brett, that's not just people who come from strict households. I think freshmen in general are known for testing all their limits, because this is the first time no one's telling them to go to bed. No one's telling them what they can and cannot drink or eat or hang out with. And really kind of like almost every college freshman that I've ever encountered. She liked to drink and party, and she developed a reputation for promiscuity, though at least some of that had more to do with the fact that she dated black men on a campus where plenty of people still looked askance at that. So we're kind of seeing a picture of who Katie is, and that's that. If you're watching this on YouTube, you see a picture of her. She's beautiful. She's a beautiful young 18-year-old freshman. And just looking at her, you wouldn't know that she's had a tough life. You know, nothing about her screams early childhood trauma. But I think knowing that is helpful to get a full picture of all that she had overcome. And when you become a mother figure at 10, I would absolutely expect when you're 18 and moved out of the house and no longer having to be a mother at age 10, basically, that you finally get to be a kid. And in a lot of ways, and a lot of freshmen do this, she was getting her first taste of like childhood. It's not just your usual 18-year-old go crazy freedom. I think she'd had a really trying start to her life, and this was her chance to finally be a kid. I think she hadn't had a chance to do up until this point. And fairly or unfairly, you hear this all the time, but guys in college who, you know, either date a lot of girls or maybe sleep with a lot of girls, maybe are known as studs, but if a female does the same thing, oftentimes the reputation is negative. Not that they're a stud or amazing, but that maybe they are promiscuous. And it sounds like that was at least the reputation that Katie was developing, whether fairly or unfairly.
And I think in a lot of ways, Katie was a woman amongst children. I think she had to grow up a lot faster than a lot of these other kids who were there, who probably, frankly, never really dealt with any adversity in their lives. And they're going to college and they're still sort of naive and everything else. And frankly, I just think she was somebody who knew what she wanted and was ready to start living her life and had dealt with enough tragedy and pain and difficulty that if she wanted to have a drink, she was going to have a drink. If she wanted to have a party, she was going to go to a party. If she wanted to date multiple people, she was going to do it. And that was the way she lived her life. But, you know, I mean, Kentucky is basically a southern state. It's sort of a small southern college. People talk, people judge, and there was some of that going on here. And I think it's important to know all this about her. I mean, I don't know, is this relevant to what we're going to talk about? Maybe, maybe not. But I think it does sort of show a few things that are going to happen. Number one, a relationship she's going to develop with a friend who doesn't judge her. And we're going to talk about her in a second. And just sort of the way that all of this is going to go down, and unfortunately, some comments that we're also going to talk about by some university administrators who kind of use this to almost blame Katie for what's going to happen, which wasn't in any way her fault, even to the extent of some things we're going to talk about. But anyways, so, and I know some of you are probably surprised by the whole dating, the white girl dating black guys would be a problem. And that's just the way some people still are that way. You know, it doesn't matter how far we go. Interracial dating still bothers some people. I've seen it in my life. Alice, I'm sure you've seen it in yours. And it was something Katie had to deal with. And frankly, I think it was something Katie just didn't care what other people thought about this. She was going to live her life the way she wanted to live it. And her first roommate she was with didn't like the fact that she was dating black men and would eventually actually leave and move out. But because of that, Katie met probably her best friend in her life, a young lady named Danica Jackson. And Danica, she was mixed race herself. She certainly didn't care who Katie dated or what Katie did. And they immediately hit it off. They became very close friends. Even if Danica didn't like one of the boys Katie was dating, a man named Maurice. Now, it wasn't that Danica had any problem with the fact that Maurice was a black man. She had another reason that she wasn't too happy about that. Maurice had a girlfriend at the time. So she didn't like that. That's pretty good reason not to like it.
She's looking out for her girlfriend.
She's looking out for a girlfriend, but I knew a lot of people who dated a lot of people in college, so I'm not going to judge Maurice on this one either. But nonetheless, she didn't like Maurice. Maurice didn't like her. He thought that she partied too much and that she was sort of a bad influence on Katie. But either way, Katie liked them both, so they tolerated each other. Now, Katie had dreams. She wanted to be a dental hygienist. She worked her way through school during the day. She worked at a smoothie shop. And at night, she was a dancer at a strip club called Tattletales, which is another thing that plenty of people didn't approve of, including members of her family, but Katie, once again, didn't really care what other people thought about the way she lived her life. She was her own person, and she was going to follow her dreams, and she was going to walk out of college without debt. And if people had a problem with how she did it, she didn't care.
And you know, I mean, I know people will immediately have an image in their mind of who Katie is because she was a dancer at a strip club. Honestly, what I hear is someone going to school full time who has dreams of being like a very white collar job, a dental hygienist, right? And she's going to work hard to get there. And say what you may about someone who dances at a strip club, but like, there aren't many ways to make much more money than that when you're 18 years old. You know, guys love young girls who dance at strip clubs, and she can make way more money there than she can probably at the smoothie shop. But in addition, she could probably just sustain herself with the nighttime job, but she's also working at a smoothie shop during the day. You know, that's got to be a grueling schedule. So I honestly hear like a very industrious and hardworking person, even if she does also like to let loose and have fun.
I just go back to the whole, I just feel like she's just grown up. And there are probably a lot of 18-year-olds on campus who would just be stunned that another girl their age would be working in a strip club. But I just think she was more mature than everybody else, and it just wasn't a big deal to her. And it sort of set her apart. And I don't know whether any of this led to what we're going to see happen, but I do think that there is a person we're gonna talk about later on who is responsible for what happened to Katie. And he very clearly was a predator, and he very clearly was looking for people to attack. And I don't know if he knew Katie or not, but this is just all part of who she was, and it seemed like something that was important to talk about.
Yes. So the night of her death, Katie had attended a frat party at Pi Kappa Alpha. On our campus, we called them Pike. I've heard them called Pika fraternity. Now, police quickly concluded that someone at that party was responsible for the murder. And they zeroed in on a man called Steven Soles, who was at the party. At first, Soles said he had nothing to do with the murder or with Katie at all. But then his story quickly changed. He admitted to having consensual sex with Katie, but threw in quite the twist. Another student, Luke Goodrum, knocked on Katie's door, and it was Goodrum who then raped Katie before setting her on fire. All of this is strange, but it gets stranger because then Soles' story changes again. Soles admitted that he had raped and sodomized Katie, but only because Goodrum forced him to do so. He then said that he sprayed Katie's body with hairspray, though it had been Goodrum who set the actual fire to Katie's body. Now, in exchange for taking the death penalty off the table, Soles agreed to plead guilty and implicate Goodrum. That's quite the story. But Goodrum's, it's like there's a lot to dive into there. Let's just get through this first. Goodrum's trial didn't go well for the prosecution. Soles' changing story was used against him. I mean, as fantastical as that story is and as bad as it makes Goodrum seem, it does not help when your leading witness on the prosecution changes his story multiple times and is part of the crime as well. And so other than Soles and some jailhouse informants who said Goodrum had confessed, the evidence honestly was thin for the prosecution, and Goodrum was acquitted at trial. But many still wonder if he was responsible for Katie's death.
So you can see why this is an interesting case, because you have a murder that's solved pretty quickly, but then that's when the craziness starts. You have one person who's accusing another. You have a trial that results in an acquittal, which is an amazing thing in of itself, just because when you think about how vicious this attack is and how terrible it is what happened to Katie, it's sort of commendable that you had a jury that didn't just sort of convict out of hand. They didn't just say, this girl needs justice, this guy's been accused, he must have done it, we're going to convict. As we walk through this, you're going to see the holes that were in the prosecution story, and you're going to see how clever Steven Soles is. We talked a lot about Katie's lifestyle, and Steven was the kind of person that you could imagine, if he knew that information, and we're not entirely sure how much he knew about Katie beforehand, he would use that to spin a story that the police would believe. He starts with, oh, well, you know, this was consensual. This was a consensual encounter. And, you know, I guess things got out of hand. But at some point he has to explain the murder. And that's when he brings in this Luke Goodrum person.
Real quick, before you talk about Luke, that's so interesting that he admits off the bat that there was consensual sex, because it's, first of all, talk about putting yourself at the scene of the crime and also not being able to explain away the DNA that's probably going to be found on her that can't be explained away. So, like, first and foremost, the fact we hear this a lot in the first instance, if there's been a rape, when people are like, oh, it was consensual. That's why you can explain all of the DNA, the semen, and et cetera, on the victim's body. So that's a huge red flag to begin with.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And I don't know. Like I said, we're going to walk through every aspect of this case, but it's sort of amazing to me that the police believed this story, that the police believed it was someone other than Stephen. I mean, Stephen, he puts himself there. As you said, he puts himself having sex with Katie. And it's just why I wonder if the police allowed their own prejudice about Katie and who Katie was to affect the way they looked at this case, whether they just assumed that, well, Katie was, Stephen is black, Katie was promiscuous, she probably did have sex with him, and it probably was somebody else who killed him. Like, I just wonder if that was one of the things going through the police's mind. We don't know, because the police are still steadfastly claiming that they got this right the whole time, but I think as we go through the timeline and look at some of the evidence, you're going to see why the jury ended up doing what they're doing. And despite the fact that, as Alice said, there are a lot of people in Bowling Green, including the people who recommended this case to us, were kind of like, yeah, I don't know about this. There are a lot of people who still think Luke was involved. But when I look at this case, I just go ahead and tell you my bias. I think this was Stephen. And I'll be curious to see whether, as we go through the timeline, we look at the evidence, whether you agree with me or whether you end up thinking no, this was Luke who really was behind this and got away with murder. So let's look at the timeline. So this is May 3rd, 2003. So we're towards the end of the semester in Bowling Green at Western Kentucky. Western Kentucky, by the way, for those of you who are trying to place it, if you've ever seen their sports teams, they have like the big red blob that's their mascot. He's the Hilltopper. It's very unclear what he is, but he's literally a big red blob. Alice, have you seen the big red blob?
I have not, no.
Western Kentucky.
Oh, no. I totally have. I didn't know that's what it was called.
One of the most famous mascots that nobody knows what it is or where it's from, the Western Kentucky Hilltopper, red blob. So anyway, so May 3rd, 2003, class is coming to an end. People are partying, they're having a good time, and that's what's going to happen today. So it's during the day, Katie and Danica, they're hanging out, they're taking a nap, they're going shopping, they're doing all the things that you do when you're in college, and you get to do things like take a nap in the middle of the day before going out for a party later on. Katie swings by and sees Maurice. She takes him some food that she bought at a local fast food restaurant and tells him that she is going to a party at the Pike House that night, and she suggests he should come, and he says he'll think about it. You know, Maurice is sort of in an interesting position because he is dating this girl and everyone knows he's dating this girl. So Katie, of course, wants to be seen with the guy that she's dating. She wants him to come to the party. Maurice probably has some second thoughts about that. But nevertheless, she's trying to get him to come out, you know, do the boyfriend thing, come with me to the party. And he says, I'll think about it. So the day sort of continues. Katie and Danica pregame. And when they pregame, they go hard. They're in one of the dorm rooms down the hall. And they're drinking a mixture of Everclear and Sprite.
Ooh,
Alice,
ooh.
Have you ever had Everclear?
Like, barely. I think I smelled it and barely. It burned all the nose hairs off my nose. And I was like, no, thank you.
So I have an Everclear story.
Of course you do.
So when I was in law school, I had this friend, Jewish guy, who'd spent a lot of time in Israel. And he invited me over to his apartment. And he had this drink that he had learned how to make in Israel. It was called a Polish butterfly. And I say he learned how to make it. It's basically the easiest drink you can make. And it was a double shot of Everclear and then like a couple drops of blue curacao.
Double shot and a couple drops
of grenadine, the red stuff, right? The blue and the red would mix together and they'd create this very sort of pretty light purple color in this double shot of Everclear. So we took a shot. We took this shot, and it burned, like he said. But it was good, and I was feeling sort of, you know, bold. So we did another. So we did two double shots of Everclear and, like, some very minuscule amount of other whatever. And it was the weirdest thing that I've ever experienced because, basically, I went from being completely sober to completely drunk in, like, a couple seconds because it just all hit me at once. So there was no run-up to it, right? There was no, like, slowly getting drunker and drunker. It was just not drunk at all. And then the two double shots of Everclear hit, and I was just gone. So that's my experience with Everclear. And I can just imagine that Katie, who was described by everyone who knew her as very slight. So she was a cheerleader in high school, and she was the girl on top of the pyramid. So she's the one at the very top.
She's very light then.
Very light, very light. So she, I don't know. She's...
Let's just put it this way.
I was
at the top of the pyramid for a few things on my dance team, but I was not the lightest. So only sometimes was I at the top. And like in high school, I was like 105 pounds. So if she was always at the top, she was like teetering around the 100 mark or lighter.
Yeah. So, but nevertheless, you know, they're drinking Everclear and Sprite, which is a recipe for disaster. And Katie, pretty drunk before they even leave for this party.
And also, can we talk about how, like, this again is pretty common, especially if she's going to walk probably down the street to this party. No one really has to drive. It's in the dorms. Again, there's this like false sense of security. If you're drinking Everclear in the dorm room, that feels safe rather than saying drinking Everclear at a seedy bar where you don't know everybody. And so again, this, you know, I think where she is drinking is relevant because she's not drinking at the strip club where she dances. She's drinking with her best friend, you know, at home, essentially. And she's about to walk down the hall to another party, you know, down the street to another party.
And this is really important to me that we continue to emphasize because we've talked about all the stuff that people tend to judge Katie on. But I think it's very important that people recognize that none of these things lead to what happens to her. And she's not to blame for anything that happened to her. Now, is it good to get this drunk? It is not. I would not advise you to do it. I've done it before and wish I hadn't. So if you're out there listening in college, drink less. That's my advice to you. I realize that sounds very hypocritical coming from me. But nevertheless, you know, it really does only lead to problems. But nevertheless, as we said, and as we want to continue to emphasize, she's doing this with her friends. She's going to safe places. She knows the people at the Pike House. This is a small community, a small university. As Alice said, it's not like she's off doing this, you know, alone somewhere. And this is the kind of thing that a lot of people do in college because you do feel secure. And you feel like if there's anywhere in the world that you can kind of let go and just enjoy yourself, it should be college. Nevertheless, they drink a lot. They're getting ready to go to this party. So at the same time, Stephen Soles, who we mentioned before, he is at a friend's house named Sarah, and he is with some others who plan on attending the party. Now, Stephen did not attend Western Kentucky University. He was a local, and he was known as someone who liked to party and liked to steal things in equal amounts, and this sort of got him into trouble. He was kind of a consummate criminal. He was constantly committing low-level crimes. He was constantly stealing things, selling drugs, just sort of being a local dirtbag type of guy, right? And he was very well known to the police for all this. He'd been banned from various friends' houses because he would steal things from his friends. He just stole stuff all the time. So the people at the party that he's with or who are getting ready to go to the party, they're wanting some pot. And of course, Steven's going to be the guy. He's going to be the guy who knows where to go. And so they ask him, hey man, can you find somebody who can get some pot for us? And he knew just the guy, Luke Goodrum, who we talked about before. Now, Goodrum.
The Prosecutor's Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to us talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now, getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more.
So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join the over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. When you're at your best, you can do great things, but sometimes life gets you bogged down and you may feel overwhelmed or like you're not showing up in the way that you want to. And we know that this time of year is busy. We're just past the holidays. It's the new year. There's just so much going on. Well, working with a therapist can help you get closer to the best version of you, because when you feel empowered, you're more prepared to take on everything life throws at you. I know that after the holidays, hosting a lot of family, cooking, being with my kids without any sort of childcare in school, I can really get bogged down with life, and it's hard to get righted again, which is why it's so great to have BetterHelp as one of our sponsors. If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option because it's convenient, it's flexible, affordable, and entirely online.
So if you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/prosecutors today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, help.com/prosecutors.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere. No one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed, 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
From as a self-proclaimed loser, that's what he likes to call himself, he sells pot and some cocaine on the side to finance his relaxed lifestyle. He just likes hanging around Bowling Green, doing nothing, playing video games all day, partying all night, and he sells drugs to sort of keep this going. Now, there was really no reason that he should have to do this. His stepfather was from the same family that started the Dollar General store. So his stepfather is incredibly wealthy, and his mom obviously is incredibly wealthy as well. Now, this gave Luke sort of the air of privilege, and people in town sort of thought of him as kind of this rich boy gone bad. But in fact, he had a really bad relationship with his stepfather, and disagreements with him had actually sent him from Texas to Kentucky to live with his real father. So his father lived in Bowling Green. His stepfather and his mother, they lived down in Texas, living the high life off this Dollar General money. So his real father, not the heir to a retail fortune. So he lives in a much more sort of, he's not as privileged as people thought he was. It's often presented as a sort of privileged guy, but in reality, life's complicated. His life is complicated, like a lot of people's. In any event, when Stephen called Luke, Luke would normally have been the guy. He normally would have been the guy you call to get the marijuana, but he is having his own problems that night.
Whew. It's important to know the backgrounds of all these characters. When I hear a local who doesn't go to the college, who likes to attend all these parties, automatically kind of red flags are going up, because I don't know about you. I think we both went to colleges where the college was the town. And so there weren't that many. We called them townies, which is not very nice, but people who didn't go to the school, but who kind of hung around and would go to our parties. And they were viewed with kind of an air of suspicion, because they usually wanted to come by and, like, they would get in trouble with the police. They would come and kind of drink the free alcohol at the fraternity and sorority parties, even though they weren't really invited. And they sometimes, you know, did kind of these low-level crimes as well. And so that's clearly who we have here in this situation, someone who's in the vicinity but not really part of the campus life. We've talked about Luke a little bit, but there's more to him because he had this long string of domestic violence issues, and he had had one that night. An ex-boyfriend called his 17-year-old girlfriend, and that just drove Luke into a rage. He slapped this ex-girlfriend several times, pinned her to the bed, and when she tried to leave, Luke started choking her, which actually caused his roommate's girlfriend to call the police on him. Now, Luke fled as the police closed in on this because this is a serious offense, and he kind of stayed away for a little bit, but hours later, he showed back up, and his roommate told him that Steven had called. Now, Steven wasn't welcome at the apartment because he was always stealing stuff. So they were like, Steven, you can't come here. And because of that, Luke called Steven back and said that he would meet him at a bowling alley instead.
You know, if he can't even trust the guy to come over to your apartment, maybe you should just stop being friends with him. You know, I mean, red flags are going up with Steven.
It's pretty bad. Then again, this is also, he's calling the guy who has been, you know, abusing his ex-girlfriend for having communications. Oh, I'm sorry. It's his girlfriend. They're not exes, but because she got a call and she's clearly very young.
And let me say, Luke denies all this. He denies, of course he does. Luke denies that he slapped her around or he pinned her to the bed. He claims that she was drunk and he got mad at her and she ran out and was going to drive her car, and he was trying to stop her from driving her car because that would be dangerous. You know, he's really just being a gentleman. So that's what he claims happened. Now, his roommate and roommate's girlfriend, they tell a different story, and frankly, I would believe them over Luke any day. Luke is not a gentleman. He is not a gentleman, as you can see, and there's a reason Steven eventually is going to mention his name in relation to this entire incident.
And by the way, you know, if you're going to throw someone under the bus, the guy who had the cops called on him for abusing a girl that night is a pretty good one, right? Think about the optics of this. Now, Steven took Luke back to Sarah's place where the group drank and smoked marijuana, and the group was picked up and taken to the Pike party. Now, Steven was so drunk that he actually never made it into the party because he passed out in the truck. And he basically stayed passed out for the entire party. He never made it into the party at all.
And it's just crazy. This whole case, you're probably wondering all this detail. Why is this important? All of this comes together. I mean, this is one of those crimes that's just, there are so many different angles all coming together to make this happen. And this fact here that Steven passes out in the truck is one of them, as you're going to see.
In the meantime, Katie and Danica arrived at the party. Katie, remember, has already had a lot of Everclear to drink, so she's pretty drunk at this point, but she continues to drink once she gets to the party, and the drunker she got, the more belligerent she became. Katie repeatedly called Maurice, begging him to come to the party. I think we've probably seen this before, where she's probably crying on the phone and not taking no for an answer, and really just wants him to come and be the number one girlfriend. Now, Maurice finally says fine, and he comes to the party. And when he finally arrived, Katie was in really bad shape from all the alcohol she'd been drinking. Maurice suggested that Katie go home, but Katie finally got Maurice to the party, and she wanted to dance. Maurice said no and said he was going to step outside instead. And when he said this, Katie screamed at him and then slapped him in the face. And this caused Maurice to leave the party.
So things are going from bad to worse here for Katie. She's in a pretty bad place. She's pretty drunk. Maurice has left. And she is in a full-blown meltdown. At this point, she begins dancing what has been described as aggressively. I can only imagine what that means. With various guys at the party, she's obviously trying to make Maurice jealous. Somebody tells security, hey, there's a girl who's had way too much to drink. Can you do something about this? He comes over to take her out of the party. At this point, Danica steps in and tells security, look, she's just had too much to drink. Her boyfriend just broke up with her. Give her a break. I'll take her home. But at this point, a pledge named Ryan Payne offers to drive Katie back to her dorm. In fact, it was his job as a pledge to act as a designated driver for people at the party. This is before Uber, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Bowling Green, Kentucky doesn't have that many cabs. So this is actually a really smart thing that they're doing, and it's something that's fairly common in college towns where you'll have people who are acting as DDs, and this guy's a pledge. For those of you who don't know, if you're not familiar with the fraternity culture, if you're in a fraternity, you start out as a pledge before you become a full-time member, and when you're a pledge, you basically have to do anything and everything you're told to do, including things like go to a party and not drink so you can drive people around. So Ryan's trying to be helpful. This is his job. He sees somebody needs a ride. He is offering a ride. Danica is... she's kind of irritated at Katie anyway for all of this, but she also has met a guy that she really likes, and he's offered to take her back to his room. So this is kind of a godsend for her. This guy is stepping in and wants to take Katie off of her hands. Now, she knew him and trusted him, and she really wanted to keep seeing if anything was going to happen with this other guy. So she lets him take Katie home, and she tells him, if anything happens to her, I'm going to come for you. You're going to be the person I blame. You need to take care of her. This is something that Danica is going to regret for the rest of her life, but she thinks she can trust Ryan. It's his job, after all. She says, go ahead, take her home. Ryan doesn't actually have a vehicle. He has to borrow a car to take her home, and he ends up borrowing someone's truck. And what truck does he borrow? It is the same truck in which Stephen Soles is just beginning to rouse himself from his own drunken blackout.
What the heck? Like...
I know.
It's like Final Destination. It's just terrible, right? What you're seeing here is not some grand scheme planned out by some predator who's laying in wait for the perfect victim. It is like a regular drunken night, heartbreak, typical 18-year-old stuff. And this guy who happens to be in the back of a truck passed out. He didn't plan to pass out in this particular truck. He wanted to go to a party. And this is the truck that the designated driver borrows to drive Katie home. It just seems like so tragic.
And once again, if you're trying to blame Katie for this because she was so drunk, it doesn't matter. It wasn't the fact that she was so drunk. If she had anything to drink and she wants to get a ride back, she's taking a ride with the designated driver, she's doing the right thing. And yet it is going to lead her into this trap.
And some of you, I don't know what to think about this. I think it just depends. You know, pledges, it's, you know, a less nice word for it is being hazed. You've probably seen news articles about fraternities hazing their new members. That's what pledges do, right? They do whatever the older brothers ask of them, and they have to do it. Now, typically, I would think that the pledges, if they're the DD, would have a car, but... you're asked to be a pledge no matter your circumstances, whether you have a car or not. And so this does happen where you may not have a car. Your job is literally just to be the not drunk person in case the police come knocking on the door, or, you know, they're like, turn down the music, or we're really going to come send the squad car down, that sort of thing. So you're kind of an all-purpose catch-all. It's like you have to be the adult in the room. And I just wonder how it was this car that he was able to borrow. Now, on May 4th, 2003. So this is like going past midnight into the early morning of May 4th. Between 1:30 and 2 a.m., the desk clerk at the dorm sees Katie returning to the dorm, and she is alone at that time. Outside, Ryan, who had driven Katie back home, is watching, like, honestly, he's doing a great job, to make sure Katie makes it inside the dorm because she is very drunk. Then the passenger side door opens and Steven scrambles out of the truck and he says, I'm going to go holler at her. Now, Ryan was supposed to deliver Steven to another dorm because, remember, Ryan's the designated driver and Steven is clearly way too drunk to be driving. And Steven is not in Katie's dorm. So Steven was supposed to go to another dorm where he was planning to stay the night because he doesn't actually go to this school. But Ryan actually can't wait on Steven after he climbs out of the car. We've probably all been in this situation where like a drunk friend rouses, gets a second wind, and they just start doing their own thing and you can't really control them because Ryan has other people he needs to go pick up. So Ryan actually leaves and Steven makes his way inside the dorm after Katie. At 2:15, Sarah, remember Steven's friend, and Luke arrive at the dorm where Steven is supposed to be. Now, Luke takes a seat on a sofa while Sarah asks the dorm check-in girl if Steven has arrived from the designated driver. And it turns out he never did. Remember, because Ryan left to go pick up somebody else. Now, after a few minutes of discussion, Luke says he'll just go home since Steven's not there. Sarah leaves him there to go to her place where he waits on his designated driver, none other than Ryan Payne.
This is crazy. You know, Ryan's driving all over the place. You know, and the other thing, it's really important to pay attention to these times. So 1:30 and 2, between that time is when Katie shows up. That's when Steven says he's going to go holler at her. It's 2:15 when Luke is sitting on a sofa in another dorm trying to find Steven because Sarah wants to get him, but he's not there. Luke's going to go home, so he's waiting in the dorm for Ryan Payne to show up. So that's at 2:15. At 2:26, Danica calls Katie to check on her, and Katie answers. And it's obvious to Danica that she's almost passed out. And she says that basically it sounds like she's face down on her pillow talking into the phone. We've all been there. You can imagine how this is going. Danica asks her if she's okay. She says she is. She says that she's made it back to the dorm room. But at that moment, Danica hears a door shut. And Katie says somebody just came into the room and that she's scared. This whole case is kind of crazy. I mean, this part is just wild.
Like, first of all, Danica's a great friend. Really. I mean that. Like, I have sent many a friends home with a designated driver or in, like, the campus shuttle who I know is very drunk, and I have not called to follow up. So Danica is doing all the right things here.
And I get that Danica sort of blames herself for this because she let her go home without her. But I agree with you 100%. I think Danica is doing everything you could expect of a good friend to do. And in fact, Katie has made it home. And that's a really important thing. Danica sent her with Ryan and Ryan got her home and she's home. She should be safe. She should be safe. She's in her room. But at that point, Danica hears this door open. She hears it close. And Danica actually tells Katie to give the phone to whoever it is who's just walked into the room, which she does. So she hands the phone to this person. And this person says, "I'm the guy who brought her home." Which is a little weird because Danica knows who it is who brought her home. But he says, "I'm the guy who brought her home. I'm checking on her. She got sick in the truck, and I just wanted to make sure she's okay." Now, Danica says, obviously, she's okay. She made it into the room, and she tells him to put her on her side so she wouldn't choke to death if she threw up again. So she's asking him, like, you know, roll her over so if she throws up, she won't choke. Danica then thinks, and this is really important, she thinks that she hears another male voice in the background. So at this point, Danica thinks she's talking to one person and she's hearing another voice in the background, which would put two people there. Either way, Katie takes the phone back. She says, "I just want to go to sleep. I'm going to go to sleep." And she hangs up with her. The call ends at 2:28.
Oh my goodness. Okay. There's so much to cover here. Okay. At 2:35 a.m., Ryan, our designated driver, arrives at the other dorm to pick up Luke. He drives him to his car at the bowling alley, remember, where Luke previously met Steven. At 2:40, Luke stops at a gas station and buys a Coke, and there is a receipt to confirm this purchase. At 3 a.m., Luke says he arrives at his father's house where he lives. At 4:08 a.m., the fire alarm in Katie's dorm goes off. And when firefighters enter, they are shocked to find that Katie severely burned in a smoldering bed put out by the dorm sprinkler system. That's when she's rushed to the hospital, but 3 days later, she is dead. So that is the entire timeline, and a lot happens. And unlike some other cases we've talked about before, there are a lot of corresponding, collaborating evidence to support this timeline. It's a pretty tight timeline. Obviously, there are holes in, you know, in between the time she hangs up, the last person to talk to her, Danica, and when the firefighters show up. But we're working with a tight timeline here, and 2:28 to 4 o'clock is really just an hour and a half. And we have receipts that can bolster where Luke is at certain times, especially remember, Luke's receipts show him out and about after a call where Danica heard more than one voice. She could have been wrong, it's possible, but if she were to hear two voices on the call before 2:28 a.m., it wasn't Luke.
What's amazing about this, and we always do the timelines first. It's always the first thing we do. And sometimes I think we're kind of spoiling it by doing the timeline, because sometimes the timeline just tells the story. And if you just look at the timeline, certain things become obvious to you immediately. Remember, there is going to be a full-blown first-degree murder trial where Luke is looking at the death penalty if he's convicted. That is going to result from this case. When you look at this timeline, you start to think, how is that possible? We got a lot of evidence to look at, and we're going to look at that next time. But just as you walk through this, you know, Danica's on the phone with Katie. Alice is 100% right. This is not one of those where we're having to kind of guess about times and about exactly what time happened, and we're working with estimates and all this other stuff. No, we have very specific times here where we know things happened. We know that Katie gets home, 1:30 to 2 o'clock. And we know that Danica calls Katie, and she's in her dorm room at 2:26 and is off the phone with her by 2:28. And we know, assume for a second there are two people in that room. Assume Danica is correct, that there are two people in that dorm room at that time. Orion picks up Luke at 2:35 a.m., 7 minutes after this phone call ends. So even if you think there's some world in which Luke is in this dorm, which he's confirmed to be in, that Sarah dropped him off in, the one that Steven is supposed to end up in, he's in that dorm. He somehow makes his way to Katie's dorm and then makes his way back to the other dorm to be picked up by Ryan. This is only 7 minutes after the call ended. Given that timeline, it's really hard to even imagine how Luke could possibly be involved in this crime.
By the way, it's like terrifying, right? What are the odds that Danica calls at the moment that this perpetrator comes in the room? I mean, she heard him come in the room. She talked to him, and she was only on the phone with Katie for 2 minutes. But those 2 minutes, she happened to catch the killer, very likely the killer, walk into her room.
And what a bold, bold killer.
What a bold. Oh, he talked to her. He talked to somebody else. I mean, he is just lying open-faced. And he knows, I mean, he knows that anyone who looks at Katie knows just how incapacitated she is. So he just walks in, closes the door behind him. And it, most people, I think, if you saw that someone's on the phone, you assume, well, there's evidence. Someone can hear me. Something's going on. She, even in her drunken state, Katie in her drunken state, is saying things about someone who just came in and even says, I'm scared. And yet he stays. He doesn't leave.
By all rights, that should have saved her. Danica should have saved her life at that point. You know, a normal person would have left. Yeah. Yeah. Most people would have been like, okay, I'm out.
Too dangerous.
This is ruined. Yep. I was going to commit a crime, but yeah, it's too dangerous. I got to go. But obviously that doesn't happen, and we end up with this tragedy. But that call is going to become very important. And based on that call, the police are going to become very certain that there are at least two people in that dorm room. And so when Steven suggests there was another person there, they're open to believing that, and you're going to see how this all goes wrong. And what's really interesting about this case, and what we're going to really get into the next time, we talk about wrongful convictions at times. And usually when we talk about wrongful convictions, we're talking about people who claim to have been wrongfully convicted and weren't. And we go through all the reasons that they're actually guilty. And ordinarily, when you look at the arguments that people make on the other side about why they're innocent, they really start to sound like conspiracies. They get really complicated and really complex. And they involve police acting as almost masterminds who figure out a way to frame this person in this really complex way. And usually that falls apart, even on the barest inspection. Here, you're going to see how police actually get it wrong. You're going to see the kinds of things that lead the police and prosecutors to confirm their own biases, to assume that somebody who they already know is a bad person was probably involved, to ignore evidence to the contrary, and end up in a trial they never should have been in. And fortunately, in this case, they're going to lose. And I think this is kind of like the Temujin Kinsu case, frankly. This is much more the pattern that I think you should look for when you're looking at wrongful convictions than what you typically see in sort of the sensationalist press. And we're going to see more of that as we look at this next week. As you can tell, this is a crazy case. There's lots of crazy facts. We're going to dig into these even more and how we got where we got and what actually happened is going to become, I think, fairly clear to you fairly quickly, but really a tragic case and one that, it's like Alice said, it's almost like Final Destination. Just so many random things had to come together for this tragedy to happen. And unfortunately, every single one of them did. And you're going to see that even more as we continue. Well, I know we're only halfway through this. We'll finish next time, but interested in your thoughts, shoot us an email, prosecutorspod@gmail.com, @prosecutorspod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Hello to everyone watching on YouTube, and thank you so much to all our patrons who are listening to this early and ad-free. Well, Alice, before we sign off today, is there anything else you want to add?
I think if you take away anything from this timeline and what we've talked about so far, it's that we've said this several times, but I think it bears repeating. There's nothing that Katie did to bring this upon herself. This type of a predator, this boldness of him, is really unlike most crimes that you will see. And I think it would have happened, you know, it could have happened to anybody. So I think we've made that clear, but resist any temptation to victim blame here, because it is absolutely, she did not, you know, she did all the right things, honestly, except get very drunk, which again is like happens all the time when you're in college. And there's a lot to discuss here. And that the reason we're emphasizing that point is it factors into the investigation and prosecution here.
Yeah, that's a really great point to make. And it's one we've made several times, but I think it's worth making again, because there is a temptation in these cases to just assume, well, that can never happen to me, because that obviously is, you know, if she hadn't been that drunk or she hadn't been at the wrong place at the wrong time, that wouldn't have happened to her. And I think this is a really good example of how, frankly, that is not true, and how, you know, it really is the person to blame here is Stephen Soles, and he is the one who bears all the blame. So we're going to talk about that more next week and just confirm that he is the one who bears all the blame. And I look forward to doing that. But that's all we have for today. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for your support, for leaving those 5-star reviews, and for continuing to tell your friends. It means everything in the world. And we will be back next week with the conclusion of this story. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Yeah.
I guess
Bowling
this...
Green. I mean, that's another place. Bowling Green's the kind
of
place where
nowhere.
This kind of stuff to
Quaint.
Happen. There's a Corvette museum. That's where they
so
make Corvettes.
Nice.
Did you know that? Bowling Green? Didn't.
Well, that,
I'll mention
that makes
at
sense.
Some point.
That makes
I'll talk
sense.
About that at some point.
Okay, I'm ready anytime.
See. Okay. Oh, I got to get a word for you. It's been so long since we've
I
done
know.
This. I forgot how to do it.
I've missed you. I really have missed you. When do you leave again?
So we'll just go up Christmas Eve and see my parents and come back.
Okay.
And then we'll have Christmas here.
But
all right, we can record every night.
That way we don't have to worry about next week.
I would like to get 2 episodes out of this if possible. Sure, I think sure. we should be able to do that.
With 8 pages, I think.
You know us. You know us.
It might be 3.
we can. Okay. Here we go. You ready?
Yeah.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.